that's the case, you don't have access to Echo Link or IRL. So you just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, MikeKC2NJI has a wonderful archive site of past technical nets at amateurradio.tv. You can find it going all the way back to 2006, September of 2006, I believe. So please, if you have some time, check out Mike's website and take a swim in archives of the technical net. They're great things to listen to. Let me drop, and we will begin tonight's technical net. Okay. If anyone has any questions of a technical nature, or topics they would like to discuss, or comments they would like to make, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2 Uniform Alpha Hotel, the name is Rocco.
Okay, Rocco recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down tonight for any questions or topics? Okay, Rocco, you seem to be first and second and third, but hopefully things will liven up as time goes on. So what's your question for tonight, Rocco?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you. I've been listening to you for quite some time. I just got my tech license a few weeks ago, and I'm taking the general in about a week. I'd like to just ask you about if you could recommend some transmit antennas in a very limited space, some loops perhaps, or something I need to have that's kind of unobtrusive where I live, Long Island.
Okay, well, congratulations on having your tech license, and the best of luck getting your general license. You'll find that the questions are very familiar and similar to the tech questions, but thankfully they publish the question pool, so you can take a look-see and get a good idea of what you need to know. That's one of the big questions that most people talk to each other on the bands. What's a good, not everyone can move out of town and open up an antenna farm with acres and acres and be able to put up towers. So we in the suburban and metropolitan area have to be very stealthy about what we put up. To me, the stealthiest of all antennas is, as you mentioned, a magnetic loop. Magnetic loops are interesting devices. Some people convey magical, mystical concepts upon them, that they are primarily magnetic devices, not electromagnetic devices. I tend to think that they're just very good shortened dipoles that are circularly bent. There are some benefits and there are problems with them. Let me drop for a sec. The benefit is obviously that it's a relatively small area, and it's not height dependent. Antennas, dipole antennas especially, really should be elevated at least a half of a wavelength above ground. Otherwise, the reflections will cause most of the radio waves to just kind of bounce off the sky and back down nearby. And it's very good for a near-incidence vertical sky wave. If you want to communicate to someone a couple of blocks away or a mile away, that's fine, but it's not going to give you distance. The magnetic loop, though, as long as you get it a little bit close to 10 feet off the ground, and, you could probably easily deal with it 7 feet off the ground, it works very nicely. It's small, it's compact, and it's easy to hide. The downside is that it is not capable of transmitting high power. It's very dependent upon its tuning network. Because it's a shortened dipole, it has a very high Q, which means that the effective voltage at the edges where the capacitor is used is very high, and so you need a capacitor that's capable of tolerating those breakdown voltages. So it's not easy to get a magnetic loop that's capable of transmitting more than, say, 100 watts or more. But if you want to stay below that, then they work fine. Also, because they have a high Q, you have to be ready to retune it if you change your transmitting frequency. Now, some are manually tuned, which is can be a pain in the backside. Others can have a special tools attached to them where they tune themselves when you push a magic button. That adds a cost to it, but that's just one of many different options that are available for amateur radio operators. But that's probably the smallest one that I can think of.
Thank you, Roy. I appreciate that. You were mentioning about antenna tuners. Right now, I'm talking to you on a Yaesu FT3D with a diamond antenna. I don't know how my signal is. Maybe you can tell me.
Your signal is fine. You're full quieting into the repeater, which is the most important thing, and your audio is good quality. If you only use a magnetic loop, you can theoretically get around the need for an antenna tuner because the magnetic loop should be capable of tuning itself. It really is not a good idea to tune a magnetic loop remotely because the attenuation loss in your transmission line will just eat up most, if not all, of your power. So the best approach is to tune it at the actual magnetic loop. If you're using another antenna, and like I said, there's an almost infinite number of different types of antenna. One of the simplest, but not particularly stealthiest, is an N-fed, either an N-fed half-wave or an N-fed non-resonant, usually that has a high transformation impedance balance, an is 49-1 or something. And for that, you need good grounding. The beauty of that is that you just need to attach it at two points, one being very close to your house and one far enough away. You got to get height, though, for something like that. That would benefit a great deal from an antenna tuner.
Thank you very much, back to net.
You're welcome, Rocco. I'd be interested if other people out there have a good idea for stealth antennas. One of the stealth antennas that I've heard on the radio discussed, I think on this TechNet, was the so-called flagpole antenna, which is a cute idea. What you basically do is you're running a dipole. Well, you can run either a vertical or you can run a dipole in the vertical orientation and hide it inside a flagpole, and it just looks like you're patriotic.
A2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Who was describing an UNUN antenna, but with the transformer at the feed point rather than, you know, at the radio. And I wonder what you think the difference would be with that. In fact, they sell one commercially. I forget the name of it right now. But electrically, what would be the difference, Roy? Go ahead.
Impedance matching at the antenna feed is the optimal place to do this. That's because it doesn't correct for the impedance mismatch until it goes through the UNUN or the antenna tuner or whatever you have that's doing impedance transformation. So when you're running that 3-to-1, 4-to-1, 5-to-1 VizWatt through the transmission line before it reaches your shack-based antenna tuner, you're going to get a lot of reflection and a lot of attenuation loss. So that's the reason why people weatherize and remote control antenna tuners place right against the problem is that if and when they fail, depending upon where you put your antenna, it's a little bit of a pain in the backside to get to it and to fix it. But as far as the efficiency of energy transfer from your transmitter to your antenna radiating RF, that's the best way to go.
so the unon right at the feed point to the antenna, to the wire, which is essentially a sloper, I guess, would make that much of a difference, huh?
Yeah, depending upon what kind of impedances you're dealing with, if you happen to have an unon that's correcting the impedance mismatch relatively well, then it makes a dramatic difference. If unfortunately it's not really correcting it as well as you would want, and you further have to tweak it at your shack, then you still have some losses due to a impedance mismatch up until the antenna tuner portion.
Doesn't matter, of course, whether it's a 49-to-1 or a 9-to-1. It's all the same, correct?
Well, not necessarily. It ultimately depends upon what kind of impedance you're trying to match. The reason why most people cite either 1-to-64 or 1-to-49 unons is simply because the way transformers work, it's the square of the difference between the winds. So if you have something where the primary is wound twice and the secondary is wound 16 times, that's an 8-to-1, that's a 64-to-1 impedance transformation. You want a 1-to-64 or a 1-to-49 if you are operating a full wave end set. Because as you approach the full wave, the impedance of that antenna input approaches somewhere between 2 and 3,000 ohms. So you want to bring it really as close down to nominal 50 ohms as possible. So that's the reason for the 49 or the 64 to 1. If it is a non-resonant long end set, there will be times where your impedance will be high, you know, 2,000 or 3,000, there will be times where your impedance will be much lower. And that's usually why people who are non-resident NFEDs will put a 9-to-1 instead and let their antenna tuner deal with the rest.
Got it. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. Anyone else with any kind of pointers on stealthy antennas? I find miraculously that height does all kinds of wonderful things about antennas. I had originally set up a part of my antenna system in my backyard. I kind of built it up and tested it, and it frightened a lot of people. But surprisingly, once I had it mounted on my roof, no one... So height is very useful. I know people who look into... once again, anyone out there want to volunteer anything that they've discovered as far as a stealthy, almost perfect antenna for the metropolitan or suburban area? Okay, no one with opinions about antennas. I got to write this date down. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Longmark Technical Net. It's been going strong since 1982. And archives are available at MikeKC2NJI's amateurradio.tv. So, once again, if anyone out there has any questions or topics they would like to cover, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Not so quick about the antennas, Roy. This is W2BZ. Let me see if I have it. When I was a young man, I was in a stealthy antenna, but an antenna that was very popular was a cubicle quad. Don't see many of them anymore or hear about them anymore, and I've wondered for a long time why that is. favor, if in fact they have gone out of favor. Go ahead.
Well, Rich, I can't tell you for a fact how many are up there. I don't recall too many commercial designs being offered. It's a kind of make-your-own sort of thing, and a lot of people don't make their own antennas anymore, unfortunately. It doesn't really, I think, qualify as any kind of a self. It seems to me to take up a lot of space and is a little bit more obvious than your average thin wire. Either a dipole or an off-center or an end-fed and something along those lines. But, you know, it was a very effective design. Antennas do kind of go into and out of fashion. G5RVs were going, you know, if you went back about 15 years ago, I think there were a lot more G5RVs all over the place. It's kind of gone out of fashion. The same thing, I think, with J-poles. I think J-poles kind of hit their peak about 10-odd years ago, and you see a bit less of that than in past times. It's nothing, I think, anything terribly wrong with them. Everything is ultimately a compromise in one way or the other. It's just fashions change. People get bored and tired and try new things out.
My neighbor, who is also a physician, Marvin Wallach, who's now at Silent G, K2JFZ, if anybody remembers him, had a cubicle quad, and it does take up a lot of space and has a huge turning radius. Well, I don't know if that's the word, but it takes up a lot of cubic space. I guess why they call it a cubic quad. Anyway, he worked the world with it. He introduced me to ham radio, you know, ham radio, and that's why I wondered if you don't see him anymore. Thanks, Roy. W2BZ.
Yeah, they're rather large, and they take up a great deal of volume. So, you know, like I said before, different people, these things kind of go into and out of and into fashion. So I'm sure there's another time that those antennas will become somewhat more popular. If you can rig them up mechanically, they're very very good radiators. So the design is very sound. Nowadays, I think people are looking for stealthier, less mechanically demanding antenna designs. But that might change down the road. You never know. Once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Technical Net, Limox Technical Net. It's here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. If you have any questions of a technical nature, this is as good a place as any to ask them. So, my name is Roy. I'm AC2GS. Please, if you have a question or a topic that you'd like to have discussed, give me your call sign and your first name.
KB2RSG, Pete.
Yes, Pete. What can I do for you today?
Hi, thanks. So, I'm a newly active ham. I was licensed back in the 90s and have an old radio shabby shift through the operation back then. Just picked up AC2G last year, and I just got a computer director recently. Programmed the software, there's about 25 computers locally, but each and every one of them still uses standard tone, FM, you know, FM with standard tone, and then the subcarrier. The question is, how can I make use of the additional capabilities of this with local repeaters?
Okay, my first question is, because every transmitting radio uses a different protocol, unfortunately. There are some rather overpriced receivers that will receive all digital modes, but as far as transmitters, I am unaware of any other than maybe the military might be hiding. So what digital mode is your particular radio capable of?
Oh, hey, wait a minute. I thought I was the one asking the question too. That's a good question. I'm not sure. I could go fetch the manual and probably answer that one for you. Now it does X wires, which I'm not sure what that is, and also has GM on it. The actual mode, I don't know if the mode indicators on the radio will tell you the specific mode, but give me a moment and I'll go to the manual if I want to get it. So I'll write that.
Okay, Pete, you don't have to go, by the way. You've told me enough that I can suss it out. So are you still in front of the mic?
I'm still here. I'm actually in a hammock in my backyard here in Stony Brook, so I'll just want to go over to that shed.
Okay, from what you were able to tell me, you obviously have a Yaesu radio. Yaesu uses a technology they call Fusion. It's C4FM, which is just a spaceship keying mechanism for sending digital packets back and forth. Fusion is one of the three major digital modes available to amateur radio operators. There are others, but the amateurs either use DMR, which is very popular in this area. They use D-Star, which is not quite as popular, which is promoted by ICOM, and there's a Kenwood Handy Talkie that operates on that. And then there's Yaesu with their Fusion digital technology. So in order to use your Fusion radio for digital, you would have to find a repeater that can accept Fusion. If you have any Yaesu DR2X repeater-based repeaters in the area, you could just go right onto them and hit that that magic button, GM, and get into Wires X through them if they allow external Wires X. There are some repeaters that lock down their station so that they only go through one fusion room. So that's how to do it through repeaters. If you don't want to go through a repeater, there's another option. Let me drop and I'll give you option number two. Okay, option number two is something called a hotspot. Now, for the most part, if you ask people who've ever heard of hotspots about hotspots, they'll think you're talking about the gadgets that were very useful to link your laptop and your other internet-based devices through your cell phone. You would get some kind of a hotspot that would connect your internet devices through to your cellular phone contract. But this is a little bit different. This is using sort of similar technology to bridge the RF of a digital radio to the internet, to the networks attached to them. In other words, you talk on the Yaesu radio in low power. You have a hotspot that picks up the low power transmission. It then repackages it and sends it across the internet to the network that you're interested in. You can't use it for Wires X rooms directly because Yaesu doesn't want you to be able to do that. But you can access other rooms, talk groups, reflectors, what have you, and many of them are cross-linked to Wires X rooms as well. So for, say, locally, the Kings County Radio Club has a Fusion digital technology repeater, but it's locked down to its own room. You can go on a hotspot to something called an XLX gateway and tunnel into their Wires X room. It's a little on the convoluted side, and I hope I haven't confused you too much.
Okay, just wanted to let the repeater drop. Well, thank you for that information. I think I'm understanding. So when I was looking through the repeater directory that I got recently, I'm seeing obviously most of the things around here at DMR. I feel like I think I saw one or two D-Stars, but no Fusion. And the hotspot stuff I learned about at Ham Radio University last January, actually. So if I understand correctly, then, so I have a hotspot. I fire it up here locally. Communicating in digital mode between my radio and my hotspot. The hotspot is then, if I'm in my house, the hotspot is linked to my local router, and through that linkage between the hotspot and my router, it's out onto the internet and into these other areas that support digital communication. Is that Is that a good summary or a good understanding?
Yeah, Pete, that's how it works. There are a couple of little caveats. You cannot go directly from a DMR or a fusion radio directly into a D-Star reflector because they use a slightly different chip for the voice encoder decoder, and the same goes in reverse. But otherwise, yeah, that's pretty much the gist of it.
So, if I want to get the hotspot, I've got to configure to my radio, I've got to configure to my router. How do I make the connection to whatever endpoint I'm going to get to that supports the Fusion Digital? What does that hotspot do to translation and get me into some other protocol?
Yeah, basically it's doing a bunch of translations. It's taking the packet that you're sending and wrapping it inside a larger TCP transport protocol for internet and sending it off. Hotspots come in all different types of flavors. There's two major categories. There's a very nice commercial, somewhat expensive company called RF Shark. They make the OpenSpot line of hotspots. They made OpenSpot 1 and 2, and now they're selling OpenSpot 3. They have a proprietary software that they maintain. It has a very nice user interface. It updates by itself, and it's probably the most headache-free solution. If you don't want to pay the premium for something like that, the rest of them are all pretty much Raspberry Pi-based. There is a hat that handles the RF reception and transmission that plugs into it, and then you download a piece of software into a SD card, and then you have to change some of the configurations in it. It has a web-based interface, so you can set it for different gateways. You can set it up for Brandmeister, you can set it up for XLX, and through XLX, as I said before, you can select a lot of WiresX rooms are cross-connected with XLX. So you have to do a little detective work for some of this. But a lot of it is handled in the software working on either a ZoomSpot or some other brand of a hotspot. There's ways of finagling some radios to trigger the hotspot into different talk groups and such. It's a little bit easier using DMR-based radios, I think, than WiresX, but people are working on something for WiresX as well.
Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Well, no. First of all, can you hear me okay? Because there's a tremendous amount of background noise on your signal. Is mine okay?
Yeah, you're sounding good to me.
Okay, well, as you know, I'm up to my eyeballs in code plugs. I just got into this about 3.5, maybe a month ago. 3.5 weeks, maybe a month ago, and I came across something astounding. There's a company called Radiosity. I call it Radio City, but it's Radiosity, and they have a DMR radio called the GD77. When it came out, it didn't work, and the Chinese could care less. Literally, the Chinese could care less that half of the time the radio worked, half of the time the radio didn't work. Let me let it drop. But then comes along a guy, I think his first name is Dick, who decides to modify the firmware to the point where he has this radio, which is a dual band digital and analog radio, working as a hotspot if you want it to be a hotspot. And they even listed lists of hotspots now. So for $90, let's say, you can have a dual-band VHF, UHF analog digital radio, which includes a hotspot. So you wouldn't even need to buy, a hotspot if you're going to go DMR. The only thing is that if you use it as a hotspot, you need another radio to go into that hotspot, and they could be also had for cheap. It's an amazing thing that this guy has done. I was up till 5 o'clock in the morning just reading his change log, and I'm not one to do this. Let me let it drop. I mean, it was just so fascinating what he's done to this radio that right now I believe, and so do a lot of other people, believe it's the hottest digital radio on the market now, all for $90 on Amazon. Go ahead.
Okay, Rich. Well, I'm probably going to pour some cold water on that. You forgot to mention that you do need a Pi Star. If you don't have not a Pi Star, you need a Raspberry Pi in order to complete that. And that kind of begs the question that basically what you're doing is you're taking an $88 handy talkie and you're turning it into basically a hat. The MMDVM is the RF hat for hotspots that are attached to Raspberry Pi. So an MMDVM I think costs about $40-$50. So you're spending an $88 radio to do that, to dedicate yourself to doing that. So it's a fascinating thing. It strikes me a wee bit as a solution to a problem that doesn't quite exist.
Yes, it does replace the hat part of it. Sorry, I skipped over that one. But I'm not really talking about it as a hotspot. I'm talking about it as a radio that can also be a hotspot. I mean, you could do things from the front of this radio that you can't do from most radios on the market, 90% of the radios on the market. And the guy keeps going. You know, it's revision after revision. And if anybody wants a fascinating story about one guy taking a lousy Chinese radio and turning it into, again, what I feel, I don't know about anybody else, but what I feel is one of, if not the best, moderately priced digital radios on the market. Just look up GD77. I think his firmware is called GoGD77, something like that, but it's just... it's amazing what this man has done to the radio, and mine will be here by Wednesday.
We get a lot of VHF to the UHF. I've read his stuff, and it's interesting, but it certainly looks a bit kludgy. You basically... power supply to your Raspberry Pi. So you've already gone from one object, namely a handy talkie, to a handy talkie, a Raspberry Pi, and a power source for the Raspberry Pi. And that's assuming that you're going wireless on the Raspberry Pi and not tied to a Ethernet cable. So, like I said, it's a fascinating subject. I don't know if it's quite solving too many people's problems right now, but it's basically spreading off the cost of the MMDVM hat, which, again, I think is going for something like $30-$40. So there's a problem with hotspots in general is it's very easy to get very inexpensive ones through eBay from China. Some of them are bargains, and some of them are absolutely not a bargain. They're complete garbage. So caveat emptor as usual, especially when it comes to China.
Let me see if I have it. This is KBQ Lawrence Q again. So thanks for coming. Just wanted to verify one thing before I kind of close out my question. With the hotspot, once I've got it configured to my radio and I've got it configured to my wireless router, I'm assuming in order to manage this thing to hook it up to the other gateways that you had mentioned, you use a web browser, you point your web browser at the 192.168 address that hotspot is now occupying on my Wi-Fi network at home here, and then through that interface, through that software that's built into the hotspot, I can manage it and configure the endpoints to which I can connect to. Is that generally correct?
Controlling. Contact talk group list, and based upon the talk group header that you transmit to the frequency of the hotspot, it can jump from one talk group to another talk group and obviate a little bit of to a web-based command structure. But ultimately, you just use a web interface that runs on the Raspberry Pi, and you
Roy, W2BZ again. I wasn't focusing on this radio as a hotspot. I have a hotspot. I'm not even going to use it as a hotspot. I'm just saying that the other stuff that he's done is way overseeded, way overshadowed what he's done with the hotspot. So I'm not comparing it to the hat or anything else like that. It's the other stuff that he's done that, to me, is quite extraordinary. And that'll be it for me on the advertisement on the radio. Go ahead, Roy. W2BZ, I could hardly hear you.
I'm giving it as much juice as I can, so I'm not quite sure what might be going on.
Now you're still 75% readable now, as opposed to 3% readable before.
Okay, I guess 75 is better than 3. I was telling you that my understanding is the same group of people are working on patches for MD-380 because they use the same line of chips that are in the GD-77.
Fine, if you like graphics that a two-year-old could have drawn. I just can't stand, and I didn't think I'd be like this, I just can't stand looking at the interface of the MD-380. They're drawn by children, and this at least looks like a grown-up radio. Anyway, we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. I usually am. Back to that.
Well, I hope it works out for you. They put a lot of time and a lot of effort into it. So I hope you enjoy it, and you'll tell me how it went.
W2PZ back to net.
Holy doke. So, Pete, we pretty much hopefully answered your question. Okay, nothing heard. Maybe he didn't hear me. Maybe I'm just generating a lot of noise for some strange reason. Anyway, this is AC2GS. If anyone has any questions of a technical nature or topics that they would like to discuss today, please give me your call sign and your first name. Okay, well, what can I tell you? Let me just ask anyone, you know, who is listening to me through Glen Oak, let me know if my signal is intelligible or not. Maybe I'm just sending gibberish out there into the atmosphere.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You're doing very good. You know, it sounds like your final change, whatever you did, was the best. And
but now you're completely unreadable.
Okay, am I unreadable right now?
20% readable. The rest is just static.
Okay, I must admit I am not quite sure what the heck is going on. Although, I have heard lots of blades on other people come and go erratically unrelated to their transmission. So it is possible that someone somewhere is tired of their fireworks and plans to do something different before the July event. So I don't know if that's what's going on or what the hell is going on, but I haven't really changed any settings other than just pump up the power to 100% on my little ICOM 7100.
Hey, you just went from 20% to about 50% readable.
Okay, well, I'm completely confused with why it should be moving all over the place because, as I mentioned, there doesn't seem to be much of anything else going on here. I don't know what to tell you. Maybe we should, if anyone has any questions or topics or comments or something, please let me know. Otherwise, maybe we'll skedaddle over to the space report a little on the early side. But anyone have any questions, then they can actually hear me.
KD2NBP.
Yes, Bob.
Well, like other people have said, sometimes you're totally in and then sometimes you're out. I have a feeling it's not going to be something. At one point, there was total noise and all the time. All noise, like, who's talking? All noise, I don't know who it was. So, it may not be you at all. I do have a COVID question. Like, I'm reading an article in the Times from today that there's speculation, or more than speculation, about that it may be airborne particles. It may be more of a factor than people were saying. And, you know, like in enclosed buildings, air conditioning. And I was wondering your opinion on that. I guess nobody knows for sure. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Bob. Yeah, I kind of noticed the same phenomena on your transmission, although it didn't start immediately. It was, and it didn't look like it was coming from the input. It looked like there was someone transmitting noise on the output frequency of the... ...one needs to go back to their network. Anyway, as you were mentioning, it was just a whoopee-doo. It was, you know, places. A bunch of physicians wrote a nasty letter to the World Health Organization discussing that they believed that there was a good chance that the virus could be aerosolized and so could kind of hover in the air for much longer than the WHO was suggesting. And that's still unknown. It's an interesting theory that has yet to be actually proven, but, you know, we'll see as time goes on if they actually prove it or not. Most of the studies that I've seen sort of suggest the opposite, that it's primarily person-to-person contact. Recognize the significant amount of cases that are caused by, you know, people being in a room, infecting the room, leaving the room, someone else going into the room and becoming infected. So, you know, 2020 hindsight is a wonderful thing. Eventually they'll write books where it'll become crystal clear. But right now it's basically scientists arguing with each other, which is never fun.
Copy that, Roy. Yeah, I'm halfway through this article, and yeah, so I guess I'm seeing the same thing. I also had I kind of had some little radio questions that are probably easily dispensed with. I think I know the answer about my problems getting through to you on 10-meter net and stuff like that. I could wait about the COVID thing for okay, back to you, Roy.
Okay, I mean, it's up to you, Bob. I think activity is light tonight, plus the noise that's being injected into the repeater system somehow. So, you know, if you want to ask another question or not.
82-8,
Yeah, unfortunately, I couldn't make out that call sign. Could you repeat it?
82 Uniform Alpha Hotel, Rocco.
Oh, yeah, Rocco. Yeah, what can I do you for, Rocco?
Boy, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the COVID patients. I know that you're a physician with about 40 years' experience. I'm a dentist with about 30 years' experience. And we were talking about the aerosolization. By the CDC guidelines that we have to follow, I just started working last week again, we have to wait about 15 minutes after the patient departs the room, supposedly for the aerosol to settle back down onto the floor before the room can be sterilized. Do you have any opinions on that or any thoughts?
Well, you know, the trouble is that most of the studies are very preliminary. They did one study which made no sense to me where they artificially induced the fomites to not settle. They kind of whip the wind in a room to see how long they could keep it inside, you know, in an air envelope. So these are all kind of best guesses on the part of just about everyone. Ultimately, hopefully, there'll be better proven ideas of how long they stay in the air. The theory supposedly is that these fomites are reasonably heavy globules of water. Fine particles of water would not be able to hold on to a bunch of the viruses. And so the amount of time in still air that it doesn't settle to the ground, it should be very limited. Whether it is or not, again, I've seen some studies that kind of give you questionable values because they're artificial circumstances, but as far as I can see, these are the best guesses of reasonably highly educated, intelligent people without the benefit of thorough testing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I purchased some extra oral suction units to hang over the patients or so that are supposed to trap much particles. But I really kind of have doubts as to how effective they are, but only we'll see as time goes on. Back to next.
Yeah, you know, all this is unfortunately way too experimental. The thing that seems to confuse people, if they don't have a good background in science, they sort of remember their textbooks pretty much planned out the entire history of science with nary a bump nor a back flip. Science doesn't work like that. It's kind of messy. There are arguments. There are fights. And there are mistakes. And so, you know, consensus only occurs in the history books. So I wish you luck on that. It's a big bunch of questions. And there was talk about, obviously, viruses do drift genetically. All of them do. And the coronavirus has drifted a great deal. That's one of the ways that medical science is able to kind of track the path of the virus from tracking its mutations over time. And now there's a report that there's possibly a variation that might be somewhat more infectious, although it might be less deadly. So, again, there's a whole bunch of books waiting to be written someday once medical science figures all these things out.
KD2UAH, do you think there's any truth to what they're saying about the East Coast being a European variant and now the West Coast is much more, it seems virulent quickly because they have an Asian, let's say, or something that came over from the West Coast different than what we had in New York? Over.
Well, I mean, I haven't really read a great deal of what type of the virus is that's running rampant through the Sun Belt. I got the impression from articles in the New York Times on the subject that a lot of the secondary infections throughout the United States started off in areas like New York with the New York variant. So my understanding was that most of the infections that we're seeing in this country originated in Europe, actually. I'm not aware of that much general spread from the California site, although California is having a flare-up right now.
Thank you. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good, Rocco. Anyone with any other questions, either technical or topics, or if you want to discuss the virus, we're always up for that.
KD2?
Yes, I didn't get your entire call sign. I just got the KD2.
Hey, Roger. Turn on the repeater. KD2, RMD, Russell?
Okay, Russell recognized. What's your question for tonight, Russell?
Very good. If you had a choice to pick and to put aside installation and cost and money, but if you pick a NFED 40-10, half NFED, and have it perfectly vertical, okay, so the ballon is right at eye level and the end of the dipole is 65 feet up, or an inverted V antenna with the ballon equally as high, 65 feet up, and this antenna would be for DXing. Which would you pick and why? Over.
Okay, so the question is, you have an NFED. The NFED, one of the NFED endpoints is 6. So you now have the option either a lower tail or a higher, or a tail as high as the endpoint. Is that the question?
More specifically, would you pick an inverted V for 80 meters, or would you pick an NFED dipole that's perfectly vertical? Okay, it's a vertical fed antenna. You've got eye level, and the end of the dipole is perfectly straight, say, 65 feet up. Which one would you pick and why? Over.
Well, again, you're going to get different people with different opinions. If you're talking about an inverted V dipole, I like dipoles in general. The trick with dipoles is that you have to resonate them. So all things being equal, you're going to have a better radiation pattern with a inverted V dipole at resonant frequency than you will with an NFED. NFEDs have a lot of complicated nodes and radiation pattern that you don't really see in the case of an inverted V. comments, Russell, on this?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Also, with the inverted V, you're going to get... you're not going to be holding the patent that close to the ground. It'll go, it'll go up on an angle, which would be better for distance. And the vertical, that would be like putting a donut vertically around a vertically wire, and you would just be going straight out, following the, more of a ground wave. So you're going to get more of a sky wave with the inverted V. I would go with that.
Well, it's more predictable than an NFED. NFEDs are very complicated in their path, and they'll have all kinds of nodes, and you really won't know exactly what it is. It really will depend upon what frequency you're transmitting. That'll change its nodal pattern and complicate and confuse. The trick with both of these things is you want them relatively higher than lower. As you bring them down to below a half wavelength of distance to the ground, you're going to get ground reflections that are going to cause other problems. It'll cause inefficiencies because some of the RF will simply be coupled and absorbed by the ground and warm up the little earthworms. And also, the reflections will probably cause more of a near-vertical incident sky wave. RF will be directed more closely straight up and then bounce back down. You won't have an opportunity to skip it through the ionosphere and extend your propagation. So, there's a lot of features. NFEDs are great, simple things, but they work in complicated and, in many ways, unpredictable manner. That a simple inverted V doesn't. I mean, one of the best suggestions that people have made through the years is what's called a doublet, which is a non-resonant dipole. It's a dipole that isn't cut to a resonant frequency, but they use a open wire, low loss transmission line, and then they use an impedance matching device at the other end. Although you could run a antenna tuner at the site of the doublet and even lessen your losses. But some people like NFEDs, and so whatever works for them.
Thanks a lot, Roy. And the reason why I bring that up is right next to my condo, a public grass, which is only about, it's less than 10 yards in width, and just a whole lot of woods. And a tree went a month ago, and I didn't even realize this. It revealed a very tall, thick oak tree that I could climb up 60, 65 feet, no problem. I would use my old portable honey tree stand, which is probably better than my parents' house. And I could climb up that tree up in Antenna 65 feet up, and it would be easy. So I was debating... should I do an NFED, which would be perfectly vertical, so it would be halfway vertical, or an inverted V, which would, and the barrel would be a quarter wavelength in height, it would be 66 feet. Curious as to what would be the better DX antenna, a halfway vertical or an inverted V? An inverted V or a halfway vertical, what do you think would be better for DXing, despite the complications of an NFED? Over.
Well, again, it sort of depends upon your antenna tuner and how many bands you want to use. If you want to use a whole bunch of different bands, then you might get better benefit from an NFED and treat it as a vertical instead of a horizontal. Once again, just to make sure, both of these things are going to be, you want to do the NFED as a vertical, right?
I would like to do it as a vertical. Stopping me from doing, putting it lower than as a sloper, but I can climb up the tree 60 feet. I'm looking at the tree right now. I catch myself staring at it every day when I come home from work. So I just figure, you know, if you're going to put up a vertical, why not do it as high as you can? So I could get a